This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Gavin Newsom will remain the governor of California after an election widely viewed as a referendum on his handling of the pandemic. Here he is after last night's big win.
I want to focus on what we said yes to as a state. We said yes to science. We said yes to vaccines. We said yes to ending this pandemic. We said yes to people's right to vote without fear of fake fraud or voter suppression.
Newsom cruised to victory in California's big cities like Los Angeles, where Democrats held a watch party turned celebration last night in Boyle Heights. Here's Democratic Assemblymember Miguel Santiago, who represents parts of downtown L.A. and East L.A.
Voters ask themselves the question, will I be better off with whatever decision I make? And the question they're going to answer is, yeah, I'm better off. The Governor Newsom was in office. I didn't die. I had a vaccine. There was mass protections in place. This could have been a lot worse, like we're seeing all over the world and in different states. He's led when it was hard, and I'll be better off as he continues leading.
Now, farther south in Costa Mesa, supporters of Republican challenger Larry Elder, the conservative talk radio host, were naturally disappointed. And KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb was at both parties last night, talking to both the triumphant and the frustrated. And he's with us now to tell us about the mood. Benjamin, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
In deep blue L.A., most folks must have been pretty happy with the recall results, right?
They absolutely were. I mean, more than 70% of voters as of tape time right now in L.A. County cast ballots against the recall. Newsom cruised to victory across the state as well. Looking at the numbers right now, about 64% statewide voting against the recall.
Now, just a few weeks ago, Benjamin, Democrats were concerned. They were worried. Polls had showed a lot of energy amongst Republicans. Democrats were worrying that their voters would stay home or not really understand that this was, you know, a special election on a Tuesday in middle September, right?
There is no debate about that, Steve. In fact, Democrats really threw the kitchen sink at this. I mean, you had President Joe Biden in Long Beach on Monday to stump for Governor Gavin Newsom. Canvassers also have been out there for the past month pushing voters to return in their mail-in ballots. And that includes Karen Diaz, who works with the Chirla Action Fund. Now, she's been canvassing for elections like these for the last 6 years, even though she can't vote herself. She's a DACA recipient. And I spent part of yesterday with her walking around Boyle Heights. And she told me that all the progress that she and other activists have made in her mind is at stake and has been at stake during elections like these, from healthcare to driver's license.
You work 12, 15-hour days to support your family members. And I think about individuals like my family who we grew up immigrants in this country, and I want to create more protections for them. This is what election day is to me. It's a way to celebrate the progress that we have built and create new opportunities for new progress.
And it seems like all the voter turnout efforts worked for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can't argue with the results. I mean, at this point in LA County, voter turnout looks to be around 45%. Again, we're going to get more numbers as the day progresses. That's pretty good for LA County, especially during an off election year. Here's the kind of voter that Karen Diaz talked to, Eswin Quinones. He lives in Boyle Heights. He's a resident there. And you could call him a reluctant Gavin Newsom supporter. He voted against the recall, and he also encouraged his father to vote too, who recently became a citizen a few years ago.
You know, nobody's going to be perfect, so it is important to at least keep Gavin Newsom in-house until we can get somebody who has better, like, plans for the future and goals for the future.
In other words, Quinones thinks that recalling Newsom would have been a step backward, not a step forward. And that's something that L.A. City Councilmember Kevin De Leon echoed to me when we caught up later in the evening at the L.A. Dems watch party in Boyle Heights.
Let's be honest with Angelenos and Californians. We were forced to spend over $300 million just to have this unnecessary recall, which I think is a coup d'etat, quite frankly. And it's a playbook by Republicans who simply cannot win at the ballot box during normal election cycles.
Republicans recognize that they are losing again and again and again in California, and the numbers really don't look good in terms of registered voters for them.
No, they certainly don't. And after all, no Republican holds statewide office right now. Democrats hold large majorities in the legislature, super majorities for that matter, in the legislature too.
Yeah, they sure do. And this reality of one-party control is really frustrating to Republicans, or even independents who want some more choices. I met up with Mark Eng at Larry Elder's party in Costa Mesa in Orange County last night. He is a registered no-party preference voter, but he supported Elder in the recall. He also runs this nonprofit called Asian Industry B2B, which advocates for pro-business policies.
We can't continue with this very detached and aloof leadership, and I put leadership in quotes because right now we have one party controlling everything and they don't get audited. They're just like, okay, we're in power, we're kings.
And that's a common thing I've heard while reporting on this recall the past several weeks and months. Rachel Gunther was at the same party as well. She works in real estate in Orange County and emigrated from the Philippines when she was 10 years old. Having Newsom overcome the recall prompted her to bring up leaving California.
It just makes you reassess everything, you know. Do we want to stay here? You know, do we want to leave? You know, these are things that are life-changing.
And I heard the same thing, Steve, from a fifth-generation Californian that I met at the same watch party. Deanne Tate, she runs a charity for disabled and homeless veterans in Orange County. She's been doing so for about a quarter century. She's just fed up with Gavin Newsom, and I asked her why.
I'm so sick of losing. You know, I'm so sick of the idiots that come into my state and vote Democrats. Because we used to be a Republican state. We used to be red. And then all these fools moved in from other places and start telling us how to run our state.
And I want to pick up on something there, Steve. As you just heard, just as in national politics, Republicans are hearkening back to an earlier time when we were a less diverse society, while Democrats are focused on words like progress in the future.
And for now, Benjamin, I guess that's where the political power in California will continue to reside, solidly in Democratic hands. The numbers don't lie.
Yeah, I mean, California voters were pretty clear. They overwhelmingly supported the governor. They supported how he handled the pandemic. But still, some see some room for improvement. And Republicans are regrouping, looking ahead to 2022, to next year.
And we heard Larry Elder last night, the radio host, say, stay tuned. And that's exactly what we'll do. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Benjamin, thanks.
Anytime, Steve.
Well, coming up, a different kind of race, the street race, and what the city is doing to put the brakes on them. The council member behind a new ordinance, straight ahead on GLA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to KCRW's Greater LA. Steve Chiotakis here. The city council this week passed a motion aimed at curbing illegal street racing. Now, racing's been on the rise during the pandemic. A lot of times it happens late at night on wide streets, and these days amasses attention first on social media, and then that sends throngs of people to the scene. That can make it hard to pin down where those races will happen, how to patrol them, how to prevent them. Those races, of course, can prove dangerous and deadly. Well, City Councilmember Monica Rodriguez introduced a new measure that will place deterrents on streets where racers often go. And she's here now to talk more about it. Councilwoman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You introduced this motion that did pass yesterday. Tell us what it would do.
So basically what I'm instructing the Department of Transportation is to work with our Los Angeles Police Department to identify some of those corridors which have had more activity, and then for the Department of Transportation to work with our engineers to figure out some street calming measures that would help obstruct that activity. And the reason why is because, as we know, LAPD cannot be at every intersection interrupting these activities. Just as you mentioned, a lot of them are organized via social media and they're happening underground. And so by the time we actually are able to deploy resources out there, they've already long gone. So this is an opportunity for us to get ahead of that and help obstruct that activity so that we don't rely on enforcement efforts alone.
You talk about street calming measures. What are street calming measures? What do you mean by that?
So it could be a variety of tools. We've been more recently deploying traffic circles, for example. There have been a variety of bollards and different measures. There's now speed tables, that which is different from a speed hump. It's a lot longer and wider and slightly flatter. But, you know, there's a variety of tools that they have, and we just need to start investing in changing our infrastructure so that we can, again, curtail this activity and make sure that we're doing so thoughtfully with all the different components that we need to consider, because it also does impact, for example, the fire department does need to be involved in this because we don't want to also slow down response times to certain events should there be an emergency. So we have to take a lot of things into consideration. And so this is a way for us to identify some of these areas that we can pilot some of these tools and see if that would help eliminate a lot of this activity.
Isn't this a game of like whack-a-mole? Like, you know, street racing happens in one place, and then by the time the police get there, it's gone, and then it happens in another place.
Correct. And that's precisely why I'm taking this step, because I think we have to be very proactive in obstructing that activity, because to your point, it's a hard thing to chase. So when we have, you know, limited police resources to deploy out to a variety of calls that they might get in a particular evening, it makes it all the more challenging, which is why I'm seeking to invest in this type of effort, because I think it'll produce far greater results than enforcement efforts alone.
What are some of the problem streets? I mean, are we talking about streets in the valley where things are pretty much flat? Are we talking about wide boulevards, maybe late at night where people aren't necessarily driving? I mean, where do these things happen?
We have seen a substantial increase in the San Fernando Valley, and particularly because we do have very wide intersections and, you know, multiple lane roads. So in my district in Somar, where we tragically had, you know, we've had repeated events, one in which actually did result in a fatal shooting, as well as one car actually crashing, careened into one of the local restaurants at the intersection of Flint Oaks and Polk. So we've had these circumstances that have occurred, and we're just trying to do everything that we can in identifying where we are seeing a high rise in these activities and prioritizing those locations for some of these pilots.
Do folks just get issued? I mean, like, if something like this happens and they're street racing and hopefully, you know, nothing goes awry from it, you know, what you just described is awful. What happens? Is it a citation? Is it a warning? Oh, now you folks need to, you know, be better next time, or what? I mean, how does that work?
Right. So those are, you know, those penal codes are basically derived from the state. So that's what those are the tools that the enforcement tools that the LAPD has to use. And so they actually do have the ability to, what they have done is they've actually confiscated the vehicle. They've, you know, when they're able to capture those that are engaged in this activity, but they have taken the vehicle. There are penalties. But again, you know, we're also advocating in the state to make these penalties far more aggressive, because frankly, this is a public safety hazard that we all need to be concerned with. Many bystanders are affected, and of course, residents and businesses from these types of activities. And so we're trying to, you know, work with all of our partners, including at the state legislature, to help make changes to this so that we have more tools in our toolkit.
You introduced the motion, as I mentioned. What made you so aware and concerned about street racing in LA? I mean, this has been something that's been going on since cars, right?
Right. So I think, you know, clearly there is a history of street racing, but it's just gotten to a point with all the spectators that it's just become a greater public safety risk. Seeing how it's really taken over so many residential neighborhoods and intersections, and how it's legitimately caused all of these associated activities. As I said, the careening of the vehicle into a restaurant, a fatal shooting because of, you know, fights that erupt from these activities. All of these things are public safety hazards. And, you know, we saw in Burbank, tragically, how innocent bystanders, folks that were just happened to be driving in that area where the street racing occurred, there were three fatalities. And so, you know, we unfortunately are in a circumstance where we know that, you know, enforcement efforts alone are not going to help achieve what we want in to curtail this activity. And so we need to be deploying all the other resources and investing in our infrastructure to change it so that we can obstruct that activity.
I imagine that one way to confront illegal street racing is to maybe invest in places where folks can do this in a legal way. You know, you could go to Utah, to the Bonneville Salt Flats, and race your car legally over there if you wanted to, right? I mean, it's a large area. You know, you can go to a track and do it, I would imagine. I mean, are you guys, maybe there's a sanctioned track that you could establish somewhere, or people can do this to sort of, I don't want to say get it off their chest, but it's like, if you have a fast car and you work on your car and you want to really show off what it can do, where do you do that?
So I do know that there are places in the county that do offer those opportunities. And of course, everybody will say, and I've heard it, individuals say, well, we need one here in our neighborhood. And, you know, look, we are compounded with multiple needs in the city for land use, right? We have needs for housing. We're an underparked community, particularly in my district in the Northeast. So while I can appreciate the demand and the call for these things, we do have to balance all these things out. But there are facilities I know in LA County that do offer that. Now, when people say, well, you know, oh, it's inconvenient for me. Well, I guess my question is, at the threat of public safety, do you engage in these activities? And that's not quite fair to the residents in the area that are fearful of being victim to these activities.
Monica Rodriguez, she represents the 7th District on the LA City Council. Councilwoman, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Do you ever feel like your television has become almost like, I don't know, a member of the family? You probably look at that screen more than anyone else, especially during the pandemic. Well, Pippolotti Wrist knows exactly how you feel. The Swiss media artist is obsessed, actually, with the electric collective unconscious residing in our televisions and ourselves as TV viewers. You can explore this obsession yourself at the Geffen Contemporary at MoCA. There's a new exhibition there that spans more than 30 years of Wrist's work. Lindsay Preston-Zappas is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla, Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, and our very own art insider, and she went to check it out, and she's here to tell us all about it. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All right, tell us a little bit more about Pippolotti Wrist. I mean, who is she? Why this fascination with the TV room?
Yeah, so Pippolotti Wrist is an artist based in Zurich, and she has said that this world in front of and in back of the TV is like the biggest video installation she can imagine, which I think is kind of like this cheeky conceptual way to think about our society, our civilization, as like one large art project, one large video installation, and we all kind of gather around our TVs every night. So the whole show really plays off this sense of scale. It kind of zooms in, zooms out, plays with domestic space, inside, outside. And there are moments where you are watching film as something kind of separate than you, as if you'd watch on a TV. And then there are other instances where you're totally in it and immersed by her video. So she does a really good job of kind of pulling the viewer into the artwork.
There's actually a piece in the show where you can literally plop down on this huge oversized couch and channel
yes.
serve yourself, right? I mean, we all love that room, right?
Yeah. And this is exactly like such a good example of how you can be inside and outside at the same time. So this piece is called Das Zimmer, or The Room, and it's from 1994. And there's this oversized chair and couch and lamp that you can sit on and feel like a child, just like totally dwarfed by this large couch. But then the TV in the room is actually normal scale. And you can flip through channels with this big oversized remote, and you can flip through some of Pippolotti's past single channel videos. Kind of most of those were made in the 90s. And so you really feel like you're inside this installation, inside this big couch, but then also watching her film from the outside. And one thing I loved about the show is that there are really just hours and hours of her films that are represented in the exhibition. but she never sets up any expectations that you have to like sit down and watch the entire thing. So I love how this channel surfing encourages the viewer to really cut up and abstract snippets of her film. It's really impossible to kind of see the whole thing. And that notion is really liberating for video work, actually.
And when you think about like, you know, what TVs were like 30 years ago, right? And how they were sort of the center of the room, as opposed to now they're sort of, you know, a part of the wall.
Everywhere.
Right? Yeah. And you've got screens everywhere. I mean, she's seen a lot of change since she's been doing these kinds of exhibits, right?
Definitely. I mean, you can imagine just the way that digital technologies have really grown up while she's been making work. And the beauty of the show, though, and this is in part due to the curator, Anna Katz, who worked with Rist on the exhibition, is that there's this larger installation that all these videos kind of fit into and feel really seamless. So when you walk into the exhibition, you actually feel like you're outside again. There's these two large buildings and an exterior of kind of a small bungalow and picnic benches. So it feels like this shared public space. And a lot of her new site-specific videos project into this central space. So there's these videos that project up the sides of buildings or set into windows. And you can kind of tell that in this main space, she's taking advantage of newer technologies, kind of what video can do now, larger format, digital film. So I think the curation was kind of a brilliant way to kind of weave these decades of film and technology together in a really cohesive way.
I know there's one video in the show where the artist is walking down the street and smashing a bunch of car windows. What's I mean, that's right. I mean, what's yes. that about?
Yes, this video is so genius. It's called Ever Is Overall. And the artist wears, and it's from the 90s, and the artist is wearing this blue dress and red shoes. She looks very much like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. And she's kind of smiling as she walks down the street holding this large flower and then really gleefully starts smashing car windows as she's walking down. Might sound familiar. A lot of people actually accuse Beyonce of taking this idea from Rist from her Hold Up video from the Lemonade album, where yeah. she's kind of smashing car windows with a baseball bat. But for Rist, the piece is really about female liberation. You know, she's wearing this iconic outfit of the good girl, this Dorothy image, but then smashing the stereotype.
I know, Lindsay, that MoCA's seen some changes. Its director, Klaus Biesenbach, announced that he's leaving the museum. He's going to Berlin. What role did Biesenbach have in bringing this exhibition in and bringing it to life?
Yeah, I mean, really interesting timing that he made this announcement right as the exhibition opened. And Klaus really had a pretty big role in bringing this to light. He brought Pipilotti Rist to the museum, and the show really has been in the works for 3 years, basically since Klaus has been at MoCA. And, you know, he was at the press preview kind of welcoming people in and praising the exhibition. And this was just a week ago, and he really gave no indication about his departure. So I think he really wanted to do right by Pipilotti, right by the artists and the exhibition that he helped to manifest, and really let Pipilotti have a moment and this exhibition open to the public before breaking this kind of major news and shaking things up.
Well, the exhibition's called Big Heartedness, Be My Neighbor, and it's at MoCA through next June, June the 6th. Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, come along as we take a radio trip in a flying car. What are they going to look like? Who's going to make them? Who's piloting them? How soon before we see them in the air? So many questions, some answers tomorrow. Now, a little business in KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive. When you give, you secure the future for this radio station that you've relied on for so long. Whether there's a big news story you need to follow, you're seeking an escape through music and storytelling, well, KCRW has you covered. If you've been putting it off for days or months, maybe even years, this is it. Your sign to finally make that donation. You'll be glad you did. And we have this $25,000 challenge grant on the table. If we raise $25,000 by midnight tonight, KCRW champions Jeanette and Patrick Nolte will generously kick in another 25 large. How about that? That simple. Just think about how many hours of music and news and culture that money could fund. Give now. Help us secure more funding for KCRW. KCRW.com/join. 800-600-KCRW. Those are the ways to do it. KCRW.com/join. join just takes a couple of minutes, and thank you for your support. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Danielle Chiriguayo, Sonia Guy, Sue Margulies, John Meek, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, and Holly Adams, all with hands and ears on the show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have yourself a great day.